and welcome to Convergence again. I'm Ellen Taylor alongside Michelle McAloon. We dive into issues of faith and culture and how they affect us in our everyday lives. Michelle, good to talk to you again from Germany.
It's always good to talk to you, Miss Ellen.
I know, right? We're getting there. Rumor has it you're going to come stateside in another month or so, and we'll get to record in person, so that'll be good.
Can't wait. Okay. Believe me, I can't wait. Okay.
We are going to touch a little bit on religious freedom and liberty and some issues of the Supreme Court. And for that, we bring in our guest today, an expert in many areas of just life, I got to say, Andrea Pachotti Bear. She has served as legal advisor for the Catholic Association. Right now, she leads the Conscience Project, and you can see them at theconscienceproject.org. Welcome in, Andrea.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me.
Great. Good to be here.
Andrea, we had President Trump, who was very much a religious liberty and pro-life president. We've seen a change of administrations. What have you seen from your observation of the Supreme Court proceedings that has changed in the tenor between Trump and Biden?
You know, that's a great question, Michelle. Things are just starting to show themselves in the Supreme Court. And part of it is just the unique calendar that the court has. We have terms that begin in October and go to July. So midway through the Supreme Court's term this year is a presidential election and a shift of administrations. And that signifies a shift in the position of the federal government. So there have been a couple cases where the government has switched positions, previously taking one stance and now taking a different one. And actually a unique case that just came out involving what's called Title 10 grants, family planning grants. And the Trump administration had prevented kind of this union between abortion clinics and family planning. And that was challenged. And this administration was defending its rules. The Biden administration said, you know, we're planning on pulling those rules out. And so that's a big, and we don't want to continue to defend them in the Supreme Court. So I think that we're going to see more and more changes and more changes, radical changes in the position of the federal government with regard to important issues for Catholics like religious freedom and issues related to life and human dignity. And they're just starting to percolate up and it doesn't look promising.
That's kind of discouraging going into the year. It's understandable that each of these administrations, the Trump and now the Biden, have very different. They're coming at life and issues that we as Catholics find important from very different directions. Where does the Supreme Court play in all of this? I was talking to Michelle before the show, and I said, you know, a lot of courts, you kind of know their voice. You get a feeling on what they're or how they're going to rule or what the justices think. And I can't say that I really understand this court in its entirety right now of where they stand or how they might rule on issues. And so where do you see that? And is that important or is that just a peripheral thing I'm concentrating on?
No, I think you're spot on. First is to recognize that the Supreme Court is made up of nine unique minds. And that while there are nine people that have been appointed and confirmed in certain periods by unique presidents, they are independent. And our judiciary is independent. And that's very, very important. That's how our founders created it. And it allows for what we call an appropriate check and balance between the judiciary on the executive and on the legislative. I think that we can kind of read a little bit the tea leaves from last Supreme Court term. And in July, there were some really important cases, cases related to religious freedom, cases where, for example, school choice was opened up to religious schools. And we were able to see what I hope to be bearing the Blaine Amendments, which were anti-Catholic laws enacted in many state constitutions in the late 1800s, and the Supreme Court seems to be putting kind of the last shovel of dirt on burying the Blaines. We also saw the Supreme Court again coming to the defense of the Little Sisters of the Poor and their objections to the Affordable Care Act's contraceptive mandate. And we also saw a little bit of institutionalism. And that's something that is found in the Chief Justice John Roberts' position. And that's that the Supreme Court isn't going to sway radically from one side to the other. It's going to respect precedent, even begrudgingly. And we saw that in Louisiana's abortion regulation. The Supreme Court struck it down, pointing to a case that was decided 2 years prior involving Texas and an almost similar restriction. I think that the chief got it wrong, but I do respect the fact that he was making sure that the Supreme Court wouldn't kind of bend in the wind every few years, but instead would kind of be a predictable and building on precedent, as we should call it.
Which is good, because our presidency, the office of the executive, does not seem to be dependable. It kind of bends with the wind, as we shall say. You wrote in a comment that there was a glaring void in the president's reestablishment of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships. While that sounds very good on paper, what was missing when he established this office? This is President Biden.
Well, it's curious. That was an executive order. It was actually issued on Valentine's Day. So I kind of lovingly or sarcastically call it the Valentine's Day order. And what was missing was faith. And it sounds good to reopen religious freedom and partnership offices. But when I read the executive order, which is fairly lengthy, it talked about a number of very important causes like addressing low income and neighborhoods of color and the challenges that they've gone through during the pandemic. But it didn't recognize the important role of religious institutions in partnering with the government to address social ills. And instead, in my read of it, treated religious institutions kind of like an annoying second-class citizen. And I think that was a shift in tone. You know, we were all very much surprised during President Trump's administration because of his support of religion, a man that wasn't particularly known for his religious fervor individually, but he really did champion the cause of churches, the cause of religious freedom. Now we have a president who is very committed to his personal expression of Catholicism, goes to Mass every Sunday, makes a point of letting us all know about that, and yet faith isn't really core at what he's putting forward.
That has been counted on throughout much of American history, where the churches have been down at street level, helping with things that make a better society. And you particularly look at back in the past where neighborhoods of color, the Baptist Church, for example, in black neighborhoods in the South, really had a strong combination working with the government to help their citizenry. Yet it doesn't seem like the current administration really recognizes on what some of these street level churches can do. And they seem to bypass it. For what? Are they looking elsewhere, like NGOs or other operations, to pick up the slack? Is that where they see that they're going to partner with?
Well, you know, that's a really important observation, right? We can tell that there is kind of the creep of secularization into American society, this notion that either the government or general community organizations are going to respond to social problems. So we're confusing charity, which is grounded in religious teaching, from philanthropy. And by all means, you know, bring on the philanthropists to be able to help to deal with challenges at the border, with poverty, with, you know, as long as they're not inconsistent with our church teaching on the human person. But at the core, religious people gather together in community and they express their faith in response to the needs of their neighbors, especially in the Christian tradition. And that brings up a great point. This term, the Supreme Court is looking at a case that touches upon that, and it involves the Archdiocese of Philadelphia during the time of Archbishop Charles Chaput and afterwards. And since even before the city of Philadelphia was involved, the Archdiocese was addressing the needs of foster kids and orphans. And when the city got involved and started regulating foster care, they involved partners and partnered with a number of agencies, including the Archdiocese. Well, fast forward 50 years, it's been a successful partnership, and all of a sudden city officials questioned the Archdiocese on whether they would certify same-sex couples to be foster parents. And the Archdiocese, to their credit, bent over backwards to make sure that no one who wanted to foster would be denied, but needed to be true to the teachings of the church on the nature of traditional marriage. And so they said, we will not be able to certify same-sex couples, but we will happily refer anyone that ever comes to us, any couple that ever comes to us, to one of the 29 other agencies working with the city. Now, it's important to note, no same-sex couple ever went to the Catholic Archdiocese to foster, but the Catholic Archdiocese said, we don't want anyone to go away because the need is so great. There was a crisis in Philadelphia. There's a crisis in foster care across the country. Sadly, the city of Philadelphia was too intolerant to accommodate the church. They froze intake of foster kids to these wonderful, successful foster homes supported by the church, and they refused to renew their contract. That dispute is before the Supreme Court. We're waiting for a decision. Probably it's going to come around June or July because it's one of those hot cases. And it's going to decide whether or not there is a way for kind of a happy coexistence where faith-based groups can remain true to the teachings of their church and at the same time respond to the needs of the vulnerable in our community.
I think that's been the same experience with the Little Sisters of the Poor. There was actually no individual bringing a case against the Little Sisters of the Poor for contraception. It's just more of a theoretical exercise than an actual injury exercise. And I may be wrong on that, but I believe I've read that somewhere, that there was really never an employee who needed contraception from the Little Sisters of the Poor. You know, again, it's just more of an exercise.
Well, let me ask one point on that, Michelle. Is this theoretical bringing cases forward in the theoretical rather than the actual injured? Is that a new way of doing this? Has that been like that in the past? Because it seems we could think up 1,000 theoretical things that could possibly go wrong.
You know, Ellen, that's a really, really great observation, something that a number of the justices, Justice Clarence Thomas in particular, has been wringing his hands over. And it goes to the issue of Article 3 of the Constitution, and it's what the courts can review. They can review what's known as cases or controversies. Federal courts do not give advisory opinions. You can't go to the Supreme Court and say, hey, you know, I've got an idea. What do you think? Is it constitutional or not? There's got to be a live dispute, and it touches on issues involving standing, that there has to be somebody who's got skin in the game. They can't just say, you know, I'm really bothered by something, so I'd like you guys to resolve this, even if it doesn't affect me. That's come up in the issue of abortion regulation, and sadly, last summer, the Supreme Court said that abortionists and abortion clinics have standing on behalf of their prospective customers or clients to be able to assert the interests for abortion access. But there was something really great that just happened 2 weeks ago, I think it was. And that involves a really brave young Christian college student out in Georgia. And his name was Chiki Uzebugnum. That took me so many minutes to work on. Someone whose last name is Pachotti. So. No, an incredible young man. And he wanted to evangelize. He's an evangelical Christian, wanted to evangelize on campus, wanted to talk about Christ and hand out religious materials to his classmates. The kind of officials at school told him he couldn't. And if he did, he could only do it on a certain area on college campus and only if he got a permit. He went through, jumped over those hurdles, got a permit, started evangelizing. And then the police, campus police came and said, somebody complained. And they said that you were, you know, disturbing the peace. And in order, in compliance with our policy about, you know, fighting words and not allowing things to disturb the peace, we're going to shut you down. Now, poor Cheeky didn't want to be disciplined. He wanted to finish his work at college. He's a bright, young, articulate man. And so he obeyed. But then he realized, you know what? This isn't just about me. This is about other people. And this is about, above all, Christ and the message and being able to share it, share our faith and exercise our religious freedom. He went to court. He filed a lawsuit. He lost along the way because of some really interesting legal issues that probably only lawyers find fascinating, which I found fascinating. And he got all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, you know what? Your case is still live, even though you graduated. Your case is still live, even though you only asked for what's called nominal damages, a dollar's worth of damage, because your First Amendment rights were violated. And even though the college changed their policy now, there's been an injury, and that injury can be rectified by the courts. And so that is a huge victory, because we see, you know, there's a lot of funny business sometimes going on in what's been dubbed the cancel culture, trying to bully people who have unpopular messages, and Christianity's becoming unpopular, into being silent. And the courts say, that's not going to happen.
That's incredible. You know, speaking about bullying churches, the Equality Act, let's talk a little bit about that. Today, Cardinal Timothy Dolan of the Archdiocese of New York issued a statement talking about how potentially injurious the Equality Act is going to be to the activity and the independence and freedom of the church. If the Equality Act is passed, goes through the Senate, which I can't imagine it would not be at this point, what groups have to the Supreme Court to try to knock this thing back?
You know, that's a really great, great observation. The Equality Act is sweeping legislation. For anyone who needs just a little refresher, it inserts into our civil rights laws, and I think it was like 52 federal statutes that will be modified by the Equality Act. It inserts into the notion of sex discrimination, sexual orientation, and gender identity. It also fools with the notion of pregnancy discrimination in a way that has a lot of experts worrying that that could open the floodgates to federally funded or state or government funded abortion. But the most invidious aspect of the Equality Act is it specifically excludes protection under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And now that I think has got the cardinal very concerned, and it should have all people of faith concerned, because if you're going to promote something that people of faith can find objectionable, there needs to be some protection. Now, I want to just make two observations. I personally don't think that the Equality Act is going to be passed by the Senate. You need 60 votes to get through the Senate, and I just don't see the numbers adding up in light of the problems that are kind of at the core of the act, problems related to what it's going to do for equality for girls and women in sports and in opportunities, what it may have the effect in our public restrooms, privacy, intimacy, security. But there's something problematic, and that was that there's this false dichotomy being set up between the interests of these newfound civil rights and religious freedom. I don't think it's an either or, and I think that it's important to push back on that. There's a way, just like the Philadelphia cases, to be able to respect people's sincerely held religious beliefs about the human person, about the nature of marriage, without demanding what I've been calling ideological conformity. That's what the Equality Act is all about. Everyone needs to think this way about a person. And I think that that's not, at the core, an American idea.
Yeah.
You sound so sane talking. I say that tongue in cheek because you don't hear conversations about differences going on in the public square like this, respecting other people's idea or personhood, or most of all, trying to find a compromise while still giving people of faith their space to honor their faith. And so I think that's part of the problem, too, is that we get this discourse so loud in the public square. And maybe that's why all these things are being led to the courts at this point because we can't seem to come together to put together reasonable laws that we could all function under as people of conscience.
You know, we still are still within our states and our state law. And so I know Alabama, the state of Alabama, through the Alabama Policy Institute, they're trying to construct something called Fortress Alabama, where they're trying to establish laws on family, abortion, on a range of issues that at the state level will be able to conform to most people's ideas of what the human person is, of a Christian, almost a Christian vision of the human person. How are these state laws, do you believe, will be challenged in this Supreme Court and under this Biden administration?
These are important issues. And there are, you know, it's important there are fundamental guidelines, right? We have the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. There's a supremacy clause, right? So if anything that the states do comes in conflict with the Constitution, the Constitution trumps. And so that's one principle. So, you know, I'm not familiar with a lot of the details. I've paid some attention to what's going on in Alabama, and I think it's incredibly virtuous. But let's say California comes up with an idea where they're going to mandate universal insurance coverage for abortion, and it doesn't allow for religious exemptions. Well, people can go and say that violates the First Amendment, and they have. And actually, under the Trump administration, the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Civil Rights fined the state of California for imposing this position without allowing for objection, conscientious objectors or religious or moral objections. So that's one thing to remember. We are united. So we have a constitution that binds us together. At the same time, states have certain areas that have been considered traditionally the purview of states. So even though we have a federal Department of Education, education is considered a matter for states and localities, the details, right? We can have overarching ideas that make sure that special ed kids receive appropriate education and supports, but the states come up with the details, right? They can make decisions on closure issues, unfortunately, or on you know, dealing with whatever the state needs. And that, we know in the education context, is the best way to serve our kids, because maybe the kids in Montana have different needs than the kids in Georgia as far as their education and what their opportunities are out there for. The same applies to health and safety. So hospitals are regulated at a state level. You know, doctors are licensed at the state level. Lawyers for the courts oftentimes have bar memberships at a state level. And so that's a really important way where our state and local governments and our state elected officials have a voice to be able to say, this is going to be the unique way that we're responding to the needs that we see, the things that are affecting us. And I think that, you know, the abortion context is a very, very critical way in which reasonable regulations of clinics, especially in light of tragic poor care being given in a lot of these places, are still the purview of state and local health and safety regulations, even if the Supreme Court has kind of made the standard a very difficult one to meet.
So we've got to this point where we are at full throttle yelling at each other. And a lot of people are looking to the Supreme Court to clarify these issues. Do you see that we are going to get more clarification on important things? Because right now in the conversation, yelling really loud is Civil Rights Equality Act we talked about, plus all the right to life issues. We've got a lot of things percolating here in the cauldron. And sometimes courts can enter in with a soothing voice, a clarifying voice, and sometimes they don't. And where do you see us going in this term? Because it feels a little unhinged a bit for me.
You know, we're definitely, everyone's a little concerned, and I think we should be concerned. I think we need to pray more, right? But I also think that there's a lot of hope, and we saw hope in, I think it was the eve of Thanksgiving from the Supreme Court, when the court stepped in to strike down restrictions on houses of worship in the state of New York. It subsequently has reaffirmed that strong position that you cannot target houses of worship at the state level and local level by closing them or putting on discriminatory restrictions on attendance in California. A decision was just handed down recently. So I think that the Supreme Court is being that steady voice at a time that's very difficult. We're still in the coronavirus pandemic. There's still a lot of concern, a lot of confusion, and a lot of government overreach. What's the response of people of faith? Defend rights, but also show that we're not crazy people either. You know, and I think it was Archbishop Salvador Corleone of San Francisco who made a very big point in his protests to free the mass from restrictions in California to say, we're going to follow normal and prudent guidelines on health and safety because we don't want anyone to be ill. We don't want anyone to feel anxious to come into mass. The Dominicans at the Thomistic Institute have offered incredible guidance that's being applied in dioceses across the country on how people can worship together in a safe way. So the calling, I think, of people of faith is not only to be courageous in defending our rights, but also to show that we're stable, prudent, measured, and helpful people for the community. We're responding to the needs of others, and we're also doing so in a way that's for the good of the society around us.
Wisdom and knowledge all wrapped
together.
Wisdom
and prudence. Wow.
I know. Yeah. Final thoughts, Michelle?
You know what, Andrea, I think you're so right, is that we, moving forward, we have to be the adults in the room. We have to act prudently. We have to think with deep wisdom. And you know something? We have the tools to do that. And it is loving God, loving neighbor. We can do this and we can be the leaders for the nation. Like you said, if as long as we follow the commandments, we can be the mature adults in the room. And that ultimately is evangelization. How do you evangelize people? Through your actions.
Amen.
Amen. Great conversation today. We've been speaking with Andrea Pacciotti-Bear from the Conscience Project. And of course, my co-host here, Michelle McAloon from Lockdown in Germany. I'm Ellen Taylor in beautiful Lower Alabama here. We thank you for joining us today on Convergence, and we'll speak to you next time.